This copyrighted audio file from the writings of David S. Lample is offered free of charge to the glory of God the Father and the praise of Jesus Christ our Lord. Detailed copyright and resource information is included at the end of this file.
First Things, a study of Genesis 1 to 11. Session 19, a comparable mate. Genesis 2, verses 18 to 20. This session first published February 25, 2024. Because I wanted to spread out our examination of the fall of man, I've purposely addressed it at stations along the way, rather than holding off until the actual event, recorded in Genesis 3. It being a monumental event that will forever change man and the world in which he lives, I did not want to reserve it, cramming it all into one session. So we have discussed it so far in chapter 1 at verses 26 and 29 to 30, chapter 2, verse 7, and in our last session, verses 15 to 17. The downside of this is that we might prematurely think of Adam and Eve as fallen before they really are in the narrative. As we approach verse 18 in chapter 2, Adam is still alone and remains in his created pristine state. As Leupold states it, quote, "a moral being standing on a very high plane of perfection," end quote. Let's read our passage, verses 18 to 20 of Genesis 2. "Then Yahweh God said, 'It is not good for the man to be alone. I will make him a helper suitable for him.' And out of the ground Yahweh God had formed every beast of the field and every bird of the sky, and he brought each to the man to see what he could, call it. And whatever the man called a living creature, that was its name. And the man gave names to all the cattle, and to the birds of the sky, and to every beast of the field. But for Adam, there was not found a helper suitable for him." Verse 18. "Then Yahweh God said, 'It is not good for the man to be alone. I will make him a helper suitable for him.'" Once again, it's necessary for us to be reminded of the narrative timeline. Some might read this verse and think they see a contradiction. How can God now identify something that is not good? Didn't he declare all of his creation very good at the end of chapter 1? Well, yes, indeed he did. But the creation of woman was accomplished within the sixth day, which is where this passage, verses 18 to 25, resides in the narrative. It was in chapter 1, verse 31, after the creation of the woman, that God declared that all was very good. Once again, chapter 2 expands upon chapter 1. It does not compete with it. It's easy to have a skewed perception of this episode. We could read it as the Almighty discovering, to his surprise, that something is missing in the man's life, and then trying out a number of possible solutions before finally discovering the correct one. That is not what is happening in verses 18 to 25. There is, as we will see, a purposeful method to God's actions here. I can only speak from personal experience, but from that, over the last 53 years, I have seen and lived the wisdom behind God's genius in stating that man is incomplete without woman. And God's genius works both ways. Both husband and wife complete each other. In fact, as Paul writes, both own each other. Turn, please, to 1 Corinthians chapter 7. 1 Corinthians 7. Let's read verses 3 to 4. The husband must fulfill his duty to his wife, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise also the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. And it goes without saying, so I'll say it anyway. The first portion of verse 4 drives today's culture absolutely insane, because they leave out the second part. It's complementary. It's the same situation for both sexes. Now back to our text. Perhaps you, like me, have read this passage in the past, thinking that God parades all the beasts of the field past Adam and only then decides that none of them are what he's looking for, and so proceeds to create one that is more suitable for the man. But if one reads carefully, one sees that cannot be the case. God says that he will make a suitable helper for the man. That is, he hasn't done it yet. Verse 19 states that God had formed, except for the NASB and King James versions, these were created during the fifth and early 6 days of creation, prior to the creation of man and woman. Chapter 1, verses 20 to 25. So all of our versions say had formed, except for the NASB and King James versions. So verse 19 states that God had formed the beasts et al. That is, he had done that in the past, so obviously none of them were suitable for the man. David Guzik makes a good point regarding the word translated helper, ezer. Quote, "We only see helping as a position of inferiority when we think like the world thinks. God considers positions of service as most important in his sight." And he cites Matthew 20, beginning with verse 25. Let's look at that. Let's read it. Matthew chapter 20, beginning with verse 25. "But Jesus called them to himself and said, 'You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great men exercise authority over them. It is not this way among you. But whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant. And whoever wishes to be the first among you shall be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many.'" Out of all the ways this phrase, helper suitable, is translated, I favor the New King James Version, which reads, "A helper comparable to him." A helper comparable to him. Leupold writes, quote, "Her position is further defined by the expression like him, kenegdo, literally as agreeing to him or his counterpart. She is the kind of help man needs, agreeing with him mentally, physically, spiritually. She is not an inferior being." And Guzik adds, she should be considered and honored as such. A woman or wife cannot be regarded as a mere tool or worker, but as an equal partner in God's grace and an equal human being." End quote. And not to put too fine a point on it, in 1 Corinthians 12:28, the Apostle Paul includes helps. The role the woman will be filling helps in that list of spiritual gifts. It's important. Now, verse 19. And out of the ground Yahweh God had formed every beast of the field and every bird of the sky. And he brought each to the man to see what he would call it. And whatever the man called a living creature, that was its name. As we discussed in class last week, Adam was assuredly no slouch in the intellect department. And note that God did not command the man to name the beasts and birds, but just waited to see what he would call them. I don't know about you, but every time I read verse 19 and the beginning of verse 20, I wonder, why are you telling me this here, God? What does this have to do with creating a partner for the man? Now, before I suggest some possible answers to that, let me first energetically declare what is assuredly not happening in this scene. Yahweh himself is not searching through these beasts in an attempt to find a mate for Adam. That would be entirely out of character for our omnipotent, omniscient God. It would be utterly ridiculous. Let me offer some reasons for this being included in the account here. First, it mirrors the pattern and sequence of chapter 1. Verses 24 to 27, in which the, quote, beasts of the earth, end quote, are created during the sixth day of creation, just before God makes man. Same pattern here. Second, one must keep in mind that in this scene, Yahweh God is the teacher and Adam the student. In this, the parade of animals before the man becomes a visual aid, as it were, and an object lesson to illustrate a fundamental truth for, not God, for the human, for man. Third, we should not imagine that Adam is viewing and naming every last animal that has been created upon the whole face of the earth. Verse 19 specifies just the wild, non-domestic beasts and birds. Verse 20 curiously adds domestic beasts, cattle, livestock, depending on your translation, adds those to the parade. There's every reason to believe that this would encompass a subset of animals. For example, fish and sea monsters and creeping things are excluded. So this seems to suggest that he assigns names only to those animals and birds he lives with regularly, in or around the vicinity of the garden. Fourth, there is the curriculum, as it were, that Yahweh is teaching the man. First, he shows a contrast. God is demonstrating how the animals are different from Adam. See all these, Adam? See how these are different from you? They're different species from you. Second, he shows a similarity. God shows Adam that all the animals have corresponding mates, which Adam presently lacks. He needs one too. So although that is in the moment, a contrast, Yahweh is speaking to what should be a similarity. All the animals have mates. Adam needs one. All the animals and birds can propagate. He cannot. As Leupold states it in this, quote, a realization of man's loneliness was to be aroused in him, end quote. In other words, to excite in him a need, the realization that he needs a mate and he wants one. He must have one. Finally, there's something that the naming of these animals teaches us. Leupold writes, at once we are made aware of the high intelligence level of the father of the human race. For the expression to give names, in the Hebrew usage of the word name, involves giving a designation expressive of the nature or character of the one named. Now, we've often looked at that in our studies about how Hebrew names express the totality of a person, a character and personality of a person. It means not just it's far more than just a label. It means that person. Well, the same thing applies to Adam naming these animals. He names them accordingly for who and what they are, each one. And Leupold continues, "This was not a crude fable where, according to a Hebrew notion, the accidental utterance at the sight of new and strange creatures were retained as names for the future. No, here was a man in deeper sympathy with nature than any have been ever since. That these names were appropriate and significant names for the various creatures appears also from the confirmatory statement of the author. Whatever man called each living creature, that was its name. Such a statement, embedded in so marvelous an account, could hardly be made unless the names given had been appropriate and worthy of man's intelligence." That's Leupold. And Kyle and Delish add, quote, "God does not order him to name them, but by bringing the beasts, he gives him an opportunity of developing that intellectual capacity which constitutes his superiority to the animal world." It's Kyle and Delish. We will make just a start at the next passage, then complete it in our next session. Let's read the next portion, Genesis 2, verses 21 to 25. "So Yahweh God caused a deep sleep to fall upon the man, and he slept. Then he took one of his ribs and closed up the flesh at that place. And Yahweh God fashioned the rib which he had taken from the man into a woman, and he brought her to the man. Then the man said, 'This one finally is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. This one shall be called woman, because this one was taken out of man. Therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and cleave to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. And the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed.'" So let's take a brief look at verse 21. "So Yahweh God caused a deep sleep to fall upon the man, and he slept. Then he took one of his ribs and closed up the flesh at that place." God does some of his best work after putting someone to sleep. In Genesis 15, God causes a deep sleep to come upon Abram before establishing with him his covenant and promise for the promised land. In Genesis 28, Yahweh declares himself to a sleeping Jacob. He says, "I am Yahweh, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give it to you and to your seed." Genesis 28:13. Here we have Adam being put to sleep so that Yahweh God can perform the first recorded surgery during the first anesthetic. This was not a trance or a state of ecstasy, as some suggest. The Hebrew tardema means a sound, insensible sleep. After the fall, God will not hesitate to inflict pain upon man. But here, before the fall, he intends a painless surgery. I doubt he even left a scar. As to what this surgery and its location represent, practically every commentator, especially older ones, expresses something similar, but David Guzik shares this version from Donald Barnhouse. Quote, "There is a beautiful Jewish tradition saying God made woman not out of man's foot to be under him, nor out of his head to be over him, but she was taken from under his arm, that he might protect her, and from next to his heart, that he might love her. Consider, for a moment, the genius of our God. Imagine the profound difference if he had made the first woman in the same way he made the first man. Genesis 2:7 says, "Then Yahweh God formed man of dust from the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. And so the man became a living being." If Yahweh had repeated the same process in his making of the first woman, where would be the unity? Where would be the intimate association? If that had been the process, we might imagine the first words from Adam's mouth as, "Who are you? What are you? Are you here to supplant me, to take my place here in the garden? Am I to compete with you?" Instead, we have, in verse 23, Adam's immediate and exquisite realization that this one finally is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. This one shall be called woman, because this one was taken out of man. She was not drawn from the dust, but from the bone and flesh of the man. She was not given breath from Yahweh God, we can only assume, for it's not stated, but received the breath of life from the body of the man. This passage, verses 21 to 25, is one of my favorites, for it beautifully, even poetically, encapsulates the genius of the marriage union between man and woman. And I recommend that, especially in these dark times in which there are those doing their best to corrupt and destroy the beauty and love of that union, even going so far as to reconfigure and redefine the very concept of the two sexes, that we take the time to dwell on, to savor, to reinforce in our own minds how lovingly, how sweetly God planned it from the beginning. There are those in our society hell-bent, and I mean that literally, hell-bent on destroying the beauty of God's creation, the beauty that exists within the union of husband and wife. Let us take the time, and we will take the time in our next session, to remember how our God always meant for it to be.
Thank you for using our Bible study resources. This has been the audio version of our weekly printed session notes. It is copyright 2024 by David S. Lample, but is offered free of charge and may be freely shared with others. All printed and audio notes are available in the Bible study section of our website at dlample.com. This website also includes our monthly devotional, Reflections by the Pond, as well as archives of our devotional publications from the last 34 years. You will also find at dlample.com all of our His Company Christian drama resources. Unless otherwise indicated, scripture in this audio file is from the Legacy Standard Bible, copyright the Lockman Foundation. Greek and Hebrew citations and definitions are from Strong's Greek and Hebrew Dictionary and the NASB Greek Hebrew Dictionary. All resources are offered free of charge in acknowledgement of the Lordship of Jesus Christ. For more information about who we are, please visit the About Us page at our website.